during the Black Death. The Black Death wiped out a third of Europe, but it was followed and helped pave the way for the Renaissance.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to the ER. Today, I am calling in from Jerusalem, and I'm joined in Washington by Ed Luce, the Financial Times chief U.S. commentator and columnist. Ed is also the author of the forthcoming book, The Retreat of Western Liberalism, which will be released on May 4th. ER nerds, I hope you've been enjoying the traveling ER show. We'll be back to the regular schedule next week with our regular team, and we have got a lot to catch up on. You can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Maybe you'll even get a coveted mug out of it. Recently, from Jerusalem and our tiny podcast studio high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. So, Ed, we were talking about your book. We were talking about the thesis that Western liberalism is in retreat, and we talked briefly about the idea that retreat was triggered not for local political reasons, but because of some of the bigger changes that are associated with the moment in which we live, the moment in which the world is moving towards being connected for the first time, how that is accelerating some change, exacerbating some differences, and also changing a lot of roles in the world. That frames your book. It also, as it happens, frames my book.
I read your book last night, and it has many virtues, the first of which is brevity. Obviously, it was longer than the TED talk you gave about the great questions of tomorrow, but it's still something you can read in an hour or two, which is great. Brevity is the soul of wit. Secondly, it's very, very thought-provoking. So I want to ask you a few questions about it. And the first is the actual question you open it with. You quote Einstein as saying that, you know, if he had an hour to figure out a great answer to how to solve the world, he would spend the first 55 minutes figuring out what the right question was. So clearly it's better to have an unanswered question than an unquestioned answer. What is the right question for these great challenges and themes we are facing in this world? What is David Rothkopf's question?
Well, first of all, I really resent the fact that you came up with that unanswered question, unquestioned answered line, which would have been really good in my book, and you could have suggested it earlier. Secondly, I appreciate your flagging the most important virtue of the book, which is its brevity.
No, I'm going to get on to other virtues and challenge you on one or two points.
Yeah, these TED books are designed to be extension of TED Talks, but also be consumable in a few hours. They're also small, and you can carry them around without injuring yourself, unlike these ungainly art books, which, you know, you can barely lift them up, or any of my recent books. But to get to your question, you know, I think what happens is that in big moments of transformation in the world, and I cite other moments like this where technology and social change outstrip the ability of institutions and belief systems to keep up with them, that it really shakes civilization to the core in the really big such moments. It actually forces us to reconsider the social contract. And in fact, the last time that there was, I think, a change quite as momentous as this was the Reformation. And that actually triggered the discussion that we have today, you know, Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and so forth over the course of a couple hundred years about the social contract and what is the nature of the social contract. But it also raised a lot of fundamental questions. What is the nature of governance? What are our individual rights as people? What is the purpose of society? What is the nature of an economy and so forth? And I see a correlation. The bigger the changes, the more fundamental questions we've got to go back and ask. Mm-hmm. And I see us at a moment where within a decade, effectively, for the first time in the history of the planet, every human being will be connected in a man-made system. And this will change the nature of identity, because identity has primarily been a geographically linked thing, and that's going to be less true. it's going to change the nature of governance, because as you change identity, you change community. As you change community, you change the groups within which you operate and who share views. And in talking about your book in the last episode, we talked about people in cities currently share more views with other people in other cities in other countries than they do with people in their hinterland. So we get new divisions. New York and London are closer to each other by far than Des Moines, Iowa, and someplace in, you know, Wales. And then on top of that, we've got technological changes driving economic changes and forcing us to ask questions like, what is a job? What is money? I mean, our grandchildren will probably never hold currency in their hands. What is war? We have cyber war where countries fight each other, but nobody's quite sure of how and when, and it goes on all the time without a declaration of war, and changes the definition of peace because we're constantly in conflict. So I think we're at one of those big watershed moments. You might argue, as you mentioned in the last podcast, that the Industrial Revolution was also similar. But we're at one of those moments where it really behooves us to go back to core questions like, what is the social contract? Why have we entered into it? What are our rights in this new world? Do you have a right to the internet? Because if you don't have access to the internet, you can't actually be an effective or competitive citizen in a society, and so forth. And I think that's the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book is to say, let's get back to the core questions that we need to ask as we look forward to this massive set of changes, or we're going to be blindsided, or we're going to play into the hands of the reactionaries like Trump and others who are simply going to try to resist these big changes and not actually grapple with the big questions we need to ask.
So I think your book raises the right questions, which of course is 95% of it. Let me just start though with a general point. You quote a wonderful line that when you were younger and doing a holiday job at Bell Labs, where your father worked, you were terrified of nuclear Armageddon. This is in the early 1970s. And your father... your father sort of indulgently smiled and he said, look, during the Black Death wiped out a third of Europe, but it was followed and helped pave the way for the Renaissance. Now, you talk about our period today being the day before the Renaissance. Now, I guess that makes Trump the Black Death, of course, and Farage. But talk to me about the optimism that underlines your book, because a lot of people are feeling pessimistic nowadays. What is the source of your optimism?
Well, I mean, let me take a step back from that and say that, you know, I do think the idea of the day before the Renaissance is a very powerful idea, and it's very accurate. We've spent the past 20 years looking at the problems of yesterday, looking at small-scale issues, looking at distractions. Terrorism is a distraction. It's a problem. It's a serious problem. It's not an existential problem. And it's much less of consequence than the coming technological changes are going to be in terms of rewiring society or redefining what conflict is or redefining what threats are, but also redefining what opportunities are. And, you know, I think the source of my optimism is a close read of history. I think one can't be a rigorous student of history and not also be long-term optimistic. Because as Stephen Pinker and others have written in books like The Angels of a Better Nature, we are living longer today. Fewer people are dying in conflicts today. There are fewer wars today. People are healthier today. They're better educated today. They have greater economic opportunities today. The bottom is rising, even if in many places the top is rising away from them too fast, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you look at history, you see the arc of history bending towards progress. And I think that's true, and it's inarguably true. The problem is that when you have periods of disruption where these big social changes take place, and we move in the Reformation from a world of principalities dominated by Catholic Church or the Holy Roman Empire to a world of nation states, we move to a world where there's a rising middle class, where corporations are first being created, et cetera, et cetera. or during the Industrial Revolution, where we start seeing the consequences of the marrying of capital and the means of production technology of the day, as Marx described it, but we also are seeing unionization and changing ways that people in society can organize themselves and so forth, that the big periods of change produce backlash and disruption and conflict. And, you know, in the case of the Reformation, the 30 Years' War, the greatest war the world had ever known until that point. And I think in the case of the Industrial Revolution, initially revolutions across Europe in the 19th century, and ultimately World War I and World War II, the greatest and bloodiest conflicts that the world has ever known. And I think as we look at this period, we have to ask ourselves, what are the short-term disruptions likely to be before we get our arms around it? What are the risks associated with the spread of cyber warfare? What are the risks associated with growing inequality? What are the risks associated with not understanding how, what a job is or how wealth is created? What are the risks associated with the backlash against globalization and the fact that people in cities have more affinity to one another than their neighbors in the country do, et cetera, et cetera? And could those lead to some very disturbing things? I think they could, and I think that's why we need to be asking the questions now.
Well, so you mentioned Hobbes, Locke, Kant, Immanuel Kant, and others as being the great philosophers who asked the really important big questions of their time as the Renaissance happened, the Industrial Revolution began to get underway. Who are today's philosophers? I mean, you call in your book, we need to understand the importance of philosophers. But of course, we are living in an age where we've got declining sort of public bandwidth for anybody very serious. We've got a backlash against expertise, and philosophers are the sort of uber experts, aren't they? They ask the really fundamental questions about the nature of society that the transformation you write about begs us to ask. So my question is, in addition to you and me, of course, are obvious, who are the other philosophers who are going to help us answer these hugely important questions?
Well, you know, I do think that is an important question. And I do think one of the conclusions that I drew in starting to ask these questions is that one of the most important questions is, where are the philosophers? Because I think we're sort of making up laws and making up rules without asking why we're having the laws and why we have the rules. And I go back to this question of, you know, what are our fundamental rights? It took us 350 years to get from the invention of the printing press to the conclusion that a right to a free press was fundamental. And through that, we went through, you know, the Glorious Revolution and John Locke and a lot of debate to come to that conclusion. Well, right now, there's a debate going on in different countries. How do you treat the Internet? The government have the right to regulate it. And we are starting to see a groundswell among some countries and say, no, you can't be a citizen. You can't get a job. You can't be competitive. You can't educate without the access to the Internet, so people have a right to the Internet. There's, I think, 9 or 10 countries in the world right now that grant the right to the Internet in their constitution. I think that's going to grow. But it raises other fundamental questions. If you have a right to the Internet, do you have a right to electricity? Because you can't actually have a right to the Internet and take advantage of the Internet unless you have access to electricity. Now, that would have seemed absurd to the common person in a political discussion 30 years ago. You know, many parts of the world, lack electricity still today. Over 1.5 billion people do. But in the new world we're entering, if you don't have access to electricity, you're out of the money. And so we ought to be asking those questions. We ought to be asking fundamental questions about how we govern ourselves, because we are coming up against new kinds of answers and challenges. You know, electronic referenda are starting, you know, they're around the corner. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? The ability to vote all the time, to eliminate the middleman, to eliminate representative government might sound appealing. Also might produce elections that are driven by emotion as opposed to thoughtful debate. And these are some of the simpler questions that we're facing. You know, there's a philosopher out there named Nick Bostrom, I encourage people to read his work, very thoughtful, on issues associated with artificial intelligence. we're 30, 40 years away from a world in which machines have intelligence that may be greater than humans. Should we allow a machine to have intelligence greater than a human? If a machine has intelligence like a human being, does the machine have rights? Now, that may sound ludicrous. Well, how could you give a machine rights? But the past 150 years of American history have involved us giving rights to corporations, which are fictional legal creations, rather than to people. I mean, the Due Process Clause of the American Constitution has been used to benefit corporations more than individuals. So one could easily imagine a big corporation saying, well, my machine has certain kinds of rights. It also is going to change our economics. Because what if we end up in a highly automated world in which people don't work? Machines do the work. How do those people get their income?
And you can imagine, in that world, if we get the answers right and we ask the questions correctly, the right questions, that we could have an extremely well-managed evolution of the species. But if we get it wrong, then we could have a sort of Blade Runner dystopian scenario in which the elites, you know, get this extraordinary medical and other sort of world that is closed off to the rest. And I guess what you're saying is that these are the decisions we have to take now. These are the questions we have to ask now. These are the roles for the modern philosophers, for the Nick Bostroms, the Ray Kurzweils, and others to play now. Are you confident we're going to do that?
No, I'm not confident that we're going to do it in the short term. I'm confident we'll get there in the long run. I also think that citizens have responsibility to ask these questions, and that's really the point of a book like this. You know, it's very easy to get hung up on the daily headlines and spend all day throwing food at your television set because you can't stand Donald Trump or Nigel Farage or Vladimir Putin or, Marine Le Pen or pick your leader. Or you can spend the whole time, as we have been, talking about the threat posed by several tens of thousands of terrorists who are mostly living in caves and rubble in the Middle East, and not actually be talking about the shape and nature of the society that we're going to be living in a few years, that our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren are going to be living in. And, you know, my sense is history's better off when you think these things true in advance rather than reacting to them too late. So the point of the book is to say, stop, take 2 hours, figure out what the questions are, and start answering them for yourselves, and take a break from the headlines. Take a break from the emotional trap of the Twitterverse, and say, look, there are big issues that have to do with the nature of life, the quality of life. Why are we here? What are we doing? Why do we work with one another? What do we want society? You know, we live in a society, you work for the Financial Times. Every day there's a story on the front page of Financial Times about some country's GDP being up or down, in which it implies that if it's up, it's good, and if it's down, it's not good. Except that we know that GDP doesn't actually reflect all the elements of economic growth in a society, and it certainly doesn't reflect whether the society is actually improving the quality of life of the people in society. When GDP was conceived of by Simon Kuznets in the Commerce Department of the United States in the 1930s, he said, don't use this as a measure of the health of a society. And yet we do. And by using the wrong metrics, we come to the wrong conclusions about whether we're doing well or not. And we're entering into a period in which coming to those wrong conclusions on a continuous basis could produce social breakdown, backlash, and so forth. And so we need to start saying, what are the right metrics? Why are we doing this? And, you know, when the TED book people came to me and said, do you want to do one of these short books? I thought this is a perfect place to encapsulate some of these questions and get our ER nerds from throwing so much food at their television.
Where does climate change fit into this?
Well, I think climate change is a big portion of it. I mean, this is by far the biggest problem that we face as a planet right now. It has been shoved aside by the hysteria around threats like terrorism. And yet, you know, I was at the Dead Sea And, you know, we drove by markers that the British left there. And by the way, you guys did a great job with the Middle East. Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
No. We're all forever in your debt. But we're driving by these signs that said, here's where the Dead Sea came to in 1917. And then you look, and it's a quarter of a mile or half a mile away now because it's shrinking, because the water is being used. This is a massive body of water. We are killing the planet. And one of the reasons we're killing the planet is precisely what I'm talking about here, is that we let industrialization and technological advancement of the past 100 years take place without asking the fundamental questions that we should be asking. What is the long-term purpose of this? Who is to be served by this? What are the risks associated from this? And, you know, one of the reasons I came to this is when I was in the government, we would have these sort of long-term planning things. And I talked to people at the National Intelligence Council about this, Greg Treverton, who was the outgoing, most recent head of the NIC, and I had a long conversation about this. And they do these long-term planning exercises, most of which end up being an extrapolation of what happened over the past 2 years. And you don't see the big disruptions coming because you're not actually asking the right questions. And that certainly is what has happened with climate change. And bigger problems are out there if we don't start asking the right questions about that now.
So I know we've only got a short period of time left, but let me just pick up on that answer and link it with your grander theme. I totally agree with your point. And the reason, one of the reasons, many reasons for reading this book is that take time out from the sort of day-to-day temporal narcissism, I think you once called it, of sort of the obsession with what's happening day-to-day. But to link in the day-to-day or the next 4, possibly 8 years of Trump with your answer on asking the right questions on issues like global warming, you know, there are people who say Trump's sort of distancing from global climate change cooperation and American leadership to tackle climate change could be game over for the planet, that this isn't just day-to-day. Trump is a real problem in terms of the withdrawal of American leadership on the most important scientific and global issue that we all face. In that way, the day-to-day does link up with these longer-term, grander questions that you are asking. How do you put Trump into all of this? I suppose that's really my question. Where does Trump fit into this?
Well, I think, you know, it's almost as though if you're trying to define what the opposite of asking the right questions is, it's denying that the questions are even important, denying that you should be asking anything, and acting in a kind of self-serving, impulsive way fueled by ignorance. If you throw into that in order to understand where you're going, you need to understand things like science, and the alternative posed by people like Trump is to wage a war against science, which is a war against knowledge, which is a war against being able to ask and frame the right questions, then Trump is the antithesis. He doesn't seek answers to questions. He poses problems that we are going to have to respond to as part of this era. He is the past. And in terms of knowledge, in terms of philosophy, it's almost Manichaean. He is the dark force. He represents the dark force. His supporters represent a dark force here, which is anti-imagination, anti-knowledge, anti-creativity, and simply for serving yourself in the moment, regardless of the consequences.
Yeah, so that's something we're going to need to get past to get to the right questions.
Well, I think so, and maybe Trump and people like Trump are actually going to create the crises that are going to force us to ask these questions further. In any event, that was a really good interview, Ed. I really appreciate your asking me questions here. But I will conclude with one question for you. Can you think of any good reason why anybody listening to this podcast should not buy both your book and my book?
I've been racking, because I anticipated that question, I've been racking my brains, and I simply can't find an answer to it. There is no good reason.
Yeah, in fact, that I should have had a chapter. That is a legitimate question that we should be grappling with in the book. This podcast will have to serve in lieu of that chapter, but let us, you know, my book doesn't provide the answers, it focuses on the questions. Let me provide an answer to that. Ed has written a really important book. You should go buy it, even if you don't buy my book. It's a really, really essential read by one of the smartest, most thoughtful commentators on what's going on in the world right now. I'm so glad, Ed, that you spent some time with us, and I hope you will do it again very, very soon.
Hugely appreciated and enjoyed that, David. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye, everybody. We'll see you on the next podcast.
You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I have been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori with the assistance of Alex Dorr. For more information about FP and to subscribe to The ER and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, or Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you very much for joining us.